This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. A couple of months ago, I sat down with actor John Turturro in front of a live audience at the Jerome L. Green Performance Space at New York Public Radio. I've done a couple of these live interviews, and this is someone who, in this business, somebody who I've admired for so many years as an actor who has appeared in so many great films and rich films and diverse films and worked with so many incredible directors and had so many indelible images from the Coen brothers and Woody Allen and Scorsese and, of course, Spike Lee. There's so many roles, worked in the theater. And for anybody who is like me, who is always desperate, and that is the word desperate, to find my next binge viewing source on TV, the night of the program on HBO. I remember writing to him and to Steve Zalian, the producer and director and creator, and to Richard Price. I was like, you know, how are you going to wrap this up in the final episode? It was just like the most incredibly nuggety thing that was happening in that show. And I love that show, The Night Of. And I hope they do more of it. But again, I love doing this program because I get to pick people that I want to talk to. I'm very grateful to our guest this evening for agreeing to do this. I don't think he does a lot of this stuff. I don't think he has the spare time. But please join me in welcoming our very special guest, John Turturro. Now, all of the things we're going to talk about, he and I, unfortunately, already covered backstage. We try to avoid that. We try to avoid getting too cozy backstage. But I remember we were talking about, and I was just briefly touching on what it's like for you to produce and write and direct your own films, because you've had this incredible career as a film actor, and you've made so many great films that are other people's projects, and you're an actor for hire, but when you do your own thing, describe to me, for example, the one you just finished.
I just finished a film called Going Places. It's a adaptation or reimagining of a French film called Les Valseuses, which is from the 70s, and it was also a book by Bertrand Blier.
Les Valseuses.
It means the waltzers or the testicles. It was a film that made Gérard Depardieu a star, actually. And it's a really transgressive sort of, it's considered kind of a classic in France. Pauline Kael was a big champion of the film. And it was a film that kind of blew my mind when I was a kid. And I was rewatching it and I wrote to Blier and I asked him, I said, would you ever think that someone could make an American version of it? And he said, yeah, I've seen your films and you're crazy enough and here's the rights. So anyway, it took me a long time to do that and, to adapt it and get the money to do it. And that's why my hair is this way. And I actually, during the course of it, was doing readings of it and I was kind of unhappy with what I was doing. And then I thought of, well, you know, there's a character that I've done in a play and I think and also in a movie and it would kind of maybe work. And I tried it and it did. And so I'm going to have reprised the character of Jesus Quintana. So he's going to be in this film. He is in the film. So I took this French movie and a character that I had created at the Public Theater, and then in another movie, and I kind of pushed them all together, and it kind of worked out, at least in my mind.
It's interesting how someone said that once about Bertolucci in Last Tango, how he picked two actors, and he identified an actor and an actress, and he went into their filmography to figure out who, through a character they had played, that character would have grown to become the character in my film.
Right. No, it's a truth. Sometimes you want to revisit somebody years later.
Right.
And you have to be kind of a little crazy to attempt to do one of these things. I started out the first movie I made, Mac, that was a play, And it took me, I worked on it for like 10 years, and it was my first movie. And after I did that, many people asked me to direct other movies, but I kind of knew that I wasn't really a director for hire. And I did
Why?
That film. Well, because I did that film because I understood that world. I grew up in it. My father was a builder, and there were no films ever made about builders. You know, it's always about, you know, gangsters or criminals or lawyers, but you never see a film about, you know, bricklayers or builders or bridge builders. And I wanted to make a film about that because it's a very challenging and dramatic business. You know, it can be a very dangerous business also.
Your father was in construction?
My father was a builder.
He was a builder.
Yeah.
And your mother was a housewife, or she had a career?
My mother was a person. She was a musician, and then she kind of gave it up. Her brothers were professional musicians, but she wanted to be like a designer. But she was a very talented person, probably the most talented person in our family. But she didn't really get a chance to do all of that, but she certainly made sure that, you know, we had that opportunity.
How many kids in your family, you and your brother?
Three boys.
Three boys.
I'm the middle child.
And what did your family think about when you wanted to go to New Paltz and then Yale Drama School? And
My father wanted me to have a backup plan. You know, he wanted me to be a lawyer or a doctor, yeah. And I was pretty good in school.
Or get your union card and learn how to...
He didn't want me to be a carpenter. He wanted me to be an architect. You know, he thought, but I wasn't really good enough in math to do that. But he wanted me to be a professional man, you know, like a lot of immigrant. My father wasn't born here. He was born in Italy, and he came here in 1931. And then he wound up being, you know, in the service. He was in World War II. He was in invasion of D-Day. And, you know, so he was a real kind of American guy. You know, he wanted me to reap all those rewards.
So when you are a child, I mean, because you and I are roughly the same age, mm-hmm. when you were young, what was film and theater in your life as a child? Was your house steeped in that?
A lot of music and I guess film. I mean, we would go to the movies all the time, but obviously probably like you, we watched Million Dollar Movie, you know what I mean? And The Honeymooners and all those classic things that really influenced us. And I mean, I think a lot of those Warner Brothers films, because they would always be on over and over again with Edward G. and Robinson and James Cagney and, you know, Burt Lancaster.
Did you have a favorite?
Oh, I loved
them all.
I loved so many of them, you know. And, you know, one time I would want to be Burt Lancaster, and then I would want to be James Cagney. And then, I mean, I still love those actors. And I love those actors because they're really physical, and you really see their whole performance. And they're still, you know, Barbara Stanwyck, you know. I just crazy about them. And I have remained so.
I remember when I was a kid, my favorite death scene was in City for Conquest.
Oh, God.
And Kazan gets shot by the river. They dump the body in the river, and the guys drop the gun, and the guy picks up the gun, and they pistol whip the guy. He wakes up, picks up the gun, he shoots Kazan, and Kazan gets shot. He has my favorite death line. He goes, "Ah, geez, I never figured on that at all."
Yeah, yeah. And he dies. That's a great one.
That's a
real tearjerker at the end because he goes blind at the end with Ann Sheridan. So you know. You always my girl, Peg. You know, at the end, he's selling newspapers, you know, and it's like, you know, James, you know, it's, that was an inspiration. And then when I was introduced, when I saw theater, when I was a teenager, my mother would take me to some plays, and I did get a chance to see Al Pacino do "There's a Tiger Wearing a Necktie."
And did you really?
I didn't, you know who he was, but my mother and I were like, wow, who's that guy, you know, in that play? And, we saw some musicals, Ben Vereen, you know, and it was like just watching live performers. I thought, wow, maybe that's something I could do because I never knew anyone in the movies.
What made you think? It's interesting because for me, I never dreamed of that. Like I thought movie stars were like hatched in pods on some other planet,
right.
And they flew them here in a spaceship, and like, you know, nobody really went and did that for a living.
No, I mean, we knew a prop man. He lived across the street from us. And that was like as close as I was to the movies. So theater was the first entree about maybe trying to do that, you know, in college. You know, it wasn't until I saw Dustin Hoffman, actually, which when I saw clips for the Academy Award, I was too young to see Midnight Cowboy. I was shocked. I remember seeing him. I was like, wow, this guy looks like someone in our family. You know, what's he doing in the movie?
You know, made a movie about it.
Yeah, how can he be in a movie, you know? And I was like kind of shocked to see him. And it was kind of shocking because he sort of opened the doors for these other Pacino and, you know, De Niro and all those guys. And but that was real. I never forget seeing those clips of, you know, for the Academy Awards.
And sure. Then when you went to New Paltz, you went for drama.
Which yeah,
they have
English.
A wonderful drama
and
program.
I had a, yeah, and I had a, did a minor in English, and yes, and I was.
And you were there for
major.
4 years.
Yes, my first play I did was One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. I played Chief Bromden. Because this Italian teacher said, you know, listen, you probably could play an Indian, so you should audition for it. You know? And I was like, all right.
Different times, folks, different times.
Can't do that now. Yeah. Yeah. If you see a lot of those guys, you know, who were Indians, like Anthony Quinn, he played Indians, you know, originally.
Yeah.
You know,
Jeff Chandler.
Jeff Chandler, yeah. Burt Lancaster.
Burt Lancaster.
Apache.
He had the body. He could ride a horse.
So, yeah.
And when you were there, what evolved for you? Like when you were at New Paltz, what do you remember propelled you want to keep going?
Well, I did a few plays, A View from the Bridge, Cuckoo's Nest. Later on, I did Night of the
You just dug it. You just
yeah,
loved
I,
it.
Yeah, I felt like I found something that I really, I was very raw. And I was not that, you know, skilled. I remember one teacher thought I was, but I wasn't afraid, you know, to try things. And I had a few teachers who took me under their wing. And they had a major influence on
Name
me.
One.
Beverly Brum. She passed away, but she
What did she give you? What did she do for you?
She basically educated me in many different ways and, you know, taught me how to break down a script, how to, you know, play an objective, you know, how to listen to the other actor, you know, how to work physically. And she spent so much time with me, you know, out of the classroom, too, that I had a bunch of teachers. They really cared about me and they cared about
That's
other
incredible.
Students. And I, you know, I'm still friends with, I never, you know, cut off my relationship with those people.
It's interesting because, like, I think about people who, and it is kind of a latent learning. Like, they say things to you and it comes back to you even
That's
years
right.
later, what they said to you. You know, I remember I had a woman, Mira Rostova, who died.
Oh, she's wonderful.
Rostova was my teacher for a year. She taught in an apartment that she borrowed from a friend of hers over by the old Barney's. But she was my teacher, and she passed away a few years ago. She was 99 years old. And we did a scene once. I'll never forget this incredible lesson she gave me of not playing everything at the expense of the other actor.
Right.
Because you're a very warm and very generous actor. You know, you have a great passion, but you're not selfish. And that's such an incredible thing I see in people. I'm always drawn to actors like that. Because Rostova would be there and the actors would do the scene. And the guy's at the table and the woman comes in her trench coat and she has her pocketbook and her bag of groceries or whatever. And the guy goes, what time is it?
Right.
He says.
Yeah, right.
And she goes, at 6 o'clock. He says, where you been? Rostova literally goes, okay, let's stop.
That's right. Well, that's right.
And she goes, she was obviously had a very heavy accent. She says, why you talk to her like this? What time is it? Where you been?
Because he prepared it. That's why
right.
He wanted to show
you. He says, why don't you not say, what time is it? Huh. Where you been? He says, where you were going, we have plenty of time to get there. You know what I mean? Because like, I worked in daytime a lot, did a soap, and there were guys we used to joke about who they always were going to like, lay into you in the scene. You
right,
know?
Right.
Even when they said they loved you, they were like, I love you, Mary.
Yeah, yeah.
God damn it, I love you. You know, and they were really like all that tension. You know what I mean? Did you feel that you had that innately, that kind of generosity of spirit you have?
I think I was a pretty good listener, but I think I refined it when I studied the Sandy Meisner technique at Carnegie Hall with Robert X. Modica. He really, that's what it's all about, you know, listening and responding and, you know, letting your partner affect you and doing out of that. And I thought that was very, very good training, and it's essential.
But then you decided to go to Yale. Why did you not want to dive in and go right to work?
I did. I tried to go to work. I was very shy about going out there and hustling. I was a school teacher for a while. I taught at, I was a substitute. I taught at Rice High School in Harlem.
What did you teach?
American history. And I also taught at a Catholic school called Our Lady Queen of Martyr, 5th and 6th graders. And I got invited back to both of these things. But I was doing showcases, and and my teacher, Beverly Brum, had gone to Yale. And I thought, you know what? I don't know really how to hustle that much. You know, I was kind of shy. So I applied to NYU and to Yale. And I got into both programs, and I got a scholarship to Yale. And I thought, well, you know, I'll give it a shot. And, you know, My father was overjoyed because he loved the masonry work at Yale. You know, I kept showing him. He was like, he didn't care. He was like, oh, my God, look at the buildings, you know. And he was like, oh, my
now
God.
Now that's a building.
Yeah. So, and then, you know, I worked a lot there. And I did old new plays, got classical plays, you know.
So when you get out of Yale, and what do you do then?
Lloyd Richards gave me a job. I mean, I auditioned, and I did two plays, one by Keith Redeen, who was a friend of mine, and one by John Patrick Shanley. Mm-hmm. And that's how I met John. And I did the light version of Danny in a Deep Blue Sea. And then eventually John brought me back to do a workshop at Circle Rep. And then I did it later on at the Actors Theater of Louisville, and then we brought it to New York. And really, that was my entree, you know, people seeing me on stage. And I got other work, you know, from that play, you know. And John really had a big effect on me. You know, he wanted me to be in, like, everything he wrote at that time. And I did every reading. But he was really supportive of me. And, you know, he's the one who really fought for me to be in Five Corners. And, you know, I really owe a lot to John.
The Five Corners was the movie with
Jodie Foster and Tim Robbins. That was the beginning, really. And then I started getting in some movies, and I worked with Billy Friedkin, and I lived to talk about it. And I worked with Michael Cimino and lived to talk about it.
Talk about that. You did To Live and Die in L.A.
Yeah.
With Friedkin.
Yeah, and that was a pretty wild movie. It was with Bill Peterson and Willem Dafoe and Johnny Pacquiao. And none of us, I don't think, had been, maybe Willem had been in the movie. And he was pretty out there guy. And you had to be careful physically. You didn't know what he was going to do to you. And we worked in a prison with prisoners, with guys on towers with machine guns. And we all had altercations with him on the film. And I didn't know, you know, this is what movie making is like, that maybe the director will jump on top of you, you know, but he did. And I think I learned a lot from working with him and working with Cimino, because you didn't know what was going to happen. I mean, it was kind of the cocaine 80s, you know, but there were directors that, you know, would tell the other actor, you know, hit him in the face, slap him in the face. Even if we were doing a scene like this, you know.
Right. You know, even if you were the patient and they were a doctor.
Right, I'm a doctor. Hit him in the face.
Hit him in the face, Bob.
Hit him in the face. So it was like the deer hunter scene, the Russian roulette scene, applied to every other scene.
Yeah. Right? And,
you know, but I learned to ride a horse on the film I worked with Cimino. And I think I learned
the
a
Sicilian?
Lot. Yeah, and it was really, I was like the only Italian person in the entire movie, you know what I mean? And I was Italian American, I'm half Sicilian, and everyone else was from all over the world. And but I think those movies really helped me for later on to be able to stand up for myself and say, you know, no, I don't agree, I'm not going to do that.
But, and is that a part of it? Meaning, because for me, you know, I remember the beginning of my career, and you might find this hard to believe, I was actually very guileless and I was very tender. And and I get to work, and I didn't want to piss anybody off. Until
right.
you're the guest in their house, and you
That's
want to
right.
be professional, and you confuse professionalism with kind of laying down and just dying.
Right.
You know
That's
what
right.
I mean? Just laying down and not having an opinion. Right. And the minute you start to have an opinion about anything,
right.
People are like, you know, oh, Jesus Christ, you know, they're, right. you know, that you're difficult. And it's very interesting that you say that. That you, I remember. On a couple occasions, I'd sit there and I'd say, this doesn't really make sense to me. And I wound up where, like, the director, I wouldn't even speak
right.
for like 3 months.
Right.
You know, it's a very difficult process
no,
when
it's
you
hard
and the director
speak
are not speaking for 3 months.
Because you know, I think the fear of being fired, if you're an actor, it's so hard to get hired. The fear of being right. fired is held over your head. And you have to get to the point where you don't care if you'll be fired. You know, to say, I'm not going to do that. And I did that on Five Corners the first day. And the guy tried to block a scene. And
Bill,
and I said, I don't want to do it. And he said, what? I said, nope. And I wanted to be sitting against the wall because the guy had gotten out of prison. And I kind of laid it down. And that was the beginning. And then I had a very good collaboration during that movie. And that's the first movie I felt like I was doing what I could do on stage, but in a movie.
And then what happens after you do... five
then
quarters.
I started getting, you know, different Spike Lee, you know, call me up. The Coen brothers knew me because I went to school with Francis McDormand. So they saw all the plays I was in. So they would see me all the time. I became kind of friends with them. So then they eventually told me they were writing a part for me. But it took them all such a long time to write Miller's Crossing because they had writer's block. And in the middle of it, they wrote Barton Fink. That's how they wrote Barton Fink. And so then Spike asked me to come in, and I read Do the Right Thing, and because he saw Five Corners. And, you know, I was excited when I read it. I said, well, this is about what's going on. And I grew up in a black neighborhood. I moved to a white neighborhood. I was bused out to an all-black school. So a lot of, you know, the issues were issues that I grew up with. And Spike and I really became very, very close friends.
The film came out in 90. So last year you had the 25th anniversary.
Yeah,
where they had some event for that, right?
Yeah,
did they screen it there in the city? What was that like for you to go back and...
Well, it was weird because, you know, I was I played the racist guy. So when we would go to Daly's, which Spike invited everyone to at LI, Long Island University on Flatbush in Brooklyn, you'd see the, you know, the five takes of me saying all these racist things. And sometimes there were people in the crew, you know, who'd never worked on a movie before, like the lady in Craft Services, and she was a black lady, and she wouldn't talk to me. You know what I mean? She actually told me, she said, you know, I hate you. You know, she told me, I hate you so much. And I told Spike, I said, man, can you tell us I'm doing a part, man? You know, he was laughing and stuff like that. So I was kind of, worried about, you know, what would happen. But it was only really positive, the response. You had. But when we saw the 25th anniversary, Michael Jackson had just died. And I have a line in the movie where he goes, fuck you, fuck Frank Sinatra. I say, yeah, fuck you and fuck Michael Jackson too. And it was right after he died. And once again, the audience let out this big response. I was like, oh my God, I can never get away.
Go back to zero again,
you know. It was an exciting movie, and lots of people had different opinions about the movie, even in the people in the movie. And
You were shooting?
Yeah, well, we had a long rehearsal process.
Describe that.
We had a real great group there because we all worked together for 10 weeks. We were on the set every day together. We rehearsed for three weeks.
In Brooklyn.
Yeah. And Danny, of course, was...
I just saw him the other day on the street.
Yeah.
Up by Lincoln Center. Oh my God.
I mean, you know, so oh he was, God. You know, flying high, and Ossie Davis and Ruby Dee and... It was very upsetting to do the end of the movie. It was very upsetting to do the end of the movie. It was really upsetting. And there was a lot of tension on the set between Danny and Spike about doing the scene the way Spike wanted.
Did this way Spike wanted it prevail? Is that what's in the movie?
Eventually, it did. It did. But it got really heated. And it actually came close to things getting a little out of control. But we managed, you know, through it and everything. But I remember I just didn't, it was sickening, you know, to do some of that part. I remember me with Giancarlo Esposito, and we had our hands around each other's throats. And you could just feel like, you know, because we were all really, you know, so close. And then we worked together on other movies after that and stuff. But that was a really special experience.
Coming up, John Turturro talks about the crisis that almost convinced him to go to medical school at age 50. Like Turturro, who once lugged film canisters around the country looking for funding, writer-director James Toback is committed to making films on his own terms.
You need a heavy dose of megalomania and a heavy dose of humility. It's a combination of the two.
Where does your humility come from?
How
do you access your humility?
The humility is that you say to your collaborators, you can either enable me to achieve what I know I can do with this movie, or you can prevent me from achieving it. I am at your mercy. If you can give me what I know you can give me.
Now, is that humility or manipulation?
No, it's humility because I know that if they're not all there for me and if I've made a wrong selection, I'm doomed.
To hear more about James Toback's story, go to heresthething.org. This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. My guest today is actor John Turturro. Turturro captivated the nation as Pino in Do the Right Thing and hasn't stopped mesmerizing audiences since. Most recently, we've seen him in HBO's miniseries The Night Of. Like his other roles, this one is raw, wholehearted, vulnerable, and brilliant. Turturro says his work on screen is helped by his experience on stage, and in his early years, he was back and forth between the two.
I did Shanley's play, Italian-American Reconciliation, and then I did Miller's Crossing.
After Barton Fink.
That was after Miller's Crossing.
It was after.
Yeah, it was after. Oh. Miller's Crossing was first, and I did that. And then they told me that they had written this movie for me, and I thought they said Bart and Fink. And and then, you know, then I mean, and out of that movie, I got a lot of work and stuff. But I always went back to the theater and continued to do theater.
Now, you met your wife
at Yale.
Yeah. And she was studying acting, obviously, as well.
We've worked together many times.
And you've directed her with that movie you did, Max.
Yeah.
She was the star of the film.
And she was a star of Illuminata, and I've done a theater with her, Master Builder.
What's that like to direct your wife in a film?
I was
married to an actress once. I'm not quite sure how that would have gone.
At first, it's not good. Because, you know, like your brother, or I've had my mother, my brother, and if they all first and they go, no. Like, you tell them, can you do this? No. You know, that's, like, you know, that's the first. And then eventually you have to learn, like, to respect each other. She's the actress, I'm the director, and we have to kind of draw lines and separate that. And it's not easy to do. I've talked to even people like Joe Cohen, you know, and he's like, I let my brother direct Fran. You know what I mean? He says, you know, it can be great once you get, you know, past that. So, and I think I've had really good collaborations with Kathy. And I think she's done some, you know, wonderful work in this.
She doesn't want to act anymore?
No, she's now studying social work.
Now, what do you observe about that where it just kind of goes, that just leaves somebody's body? She doesn't want to,
I think it happens. I'm sure it's probably happened to you. You think at one time in your life, you know, maybe it's something I want to do different.
Like, it's happened to me sometimes while I'm on the set shooting a film. I'll be like,
yeah.
I want to go home.
Yeah. I had a sort of crisis maybe 10 years ago, and told my doctor, I said, you know, I'm done with this business. I've got to do something really important like what you do. I said, I want to go to medical school. I was like 50 years old. And he was like, John, you're crazy.
Yeah.
He was like, you know how long medical school takes, you know? And he said, like, what you do is, there's a value to what you do. And I was like, no, there's not, you know? And then he talked me out of it. But, you know, it's, everyone hits that, I guess, at some time.
But it's interesting how, and I'd love to hear this in your own words, you know, the acting experience, and a lot of it has to do with the people that I'm working with, like if they can hit the ball back, you know what I mean? Like if I really like somebody.
Sure.
I did this movie, The Edge, with Tony Hopkins, and I'll never forget, they called me and they said, De Niro was supposed to play the lead, and he dropped out. They said, we got Anthony Hopkins, and I started to cry. I mean, I'll never forget, I was on vacation with my ex-wife and where her family were in Carolina at this beach house. And I sat there, I was like, started to get like these chest palpitations because I worshiped Tony so much. I just loved Tony. I thought, I'm going to get to go make a movie. It's me and him. You know what
right.
I mean? Harold Perrineau, who was on the show Lost, African-American guy, very young, very good looking. He had the funniest line, because the three of us are lost in the woods. And he said, Alec Baldwin, Anthony Hopkins, and Harold Perrineau. I wonder which one the bear is going to eat first. And so he dies in the film, you know, page 40, page 30, he gets chewed on. And he was very funny, Harold. But we do the movie, and there's Tony and I in the woods for like 4, 5, 6 weeks there in Canada. And it was just such a great, I mean, I loved it.
He's a wonderful person.
Yeah.
I actually did a movie that he directed me in, that he wrote, which I've never seen, actually.
Tony.
Slipstream, it's called. And I had so much fun working with him. I play someone who's like a figment of his imagination. And he said to me once, he said, John, he said, I'd like you to do this scene. He said, excuse the metaphor, he said, like a cockroach on fire. I said, you know, Mr. Hopkins, you are speaking my language. You know? So we laughed, we had so much fun. He's such an open guy.
Oh, yeah.
He's such a wonderful, attractive guy. And I, like you, I've always loved his work from Equus and QB7, you know, when I first saw
him. Exactly. So I can't believe you said that.
Yeah, I mean, it was my mother who told me to watch him on that. He's a wonderful person.
We do the film, and I said to him, my God, you worked with Olivier.
Right.
And I said, and you did all these plays, and they're from this great tradition. And I said, don't you ever miss the theater and doing plays? He's like, no, I hate the theater. I loathe and detest the theater.
Yeah, he hates the theater.
I was
theater.
Like, really, you do? I said, you never want to go back and do a play? He says, no, I only want, he said, all my life I wanted to move to California. Yeah. I said, and become an American film star. I said, drive my car with the top down, the sun in my face, the wind in my hair. And he wasn't kidding.
No, he's not kidding.
What he does now,
no,
this was his dream, was to be a movie star.
Yeah, yeah.
He doesn't give a shit about Shakespeare or Pinter or none of it. This great tradition.
He will ask you, why do you like to do theater?
Right.
You say, well, I like the rehearsal process, you know.
Pick a film. I mean, obviously there's many because you've got so many great films and so much great work. Well, you're doing it and you're in it and you're like, man, this is just bliss to me making this film, playing this role.
Well, some of the movies that we just talked about, when I worked with Robert Redford, when I did Quiz Show. Yeah, I gained a lot of weight and everything to do it. That was a really fun experience. And I loved working with him. And he was...
How so?
He's just like multifaceted, kind of eccentric guy, you know? And he just was so... good in specific details, physical details to help free you. And we got along just incredibly well. And I think probably shows maybe in my performance, I really was very free, you know, with him. And I really wanted to please him. I really did because he was so good looking. No, he is. He's very, you know, he's really seductive, you know, in getting you to be relaxed and everything. But he was a real consummate craftsman. You know, he's from the theater, and I loved working with him, and that was a real joy. And also a movie I made with a great Italian director, Francesco Rosi, which I was an adaptation of a Primo Levi book, La Tregua. And I was involved with that for about 5 years. And I think that's one of the best things I've ever done. I don't really talk a lot in the film. But I also got a real education with him in Italian filmmaking, and also I got to study everything about Primo Levi for like 4 or 5 years. And I think it really changed my life.
So I don't like the word foodie, but you're someone who you appreciate. You're into cooking, and your wife are into cooking. Is it true you guys sit down, you have like these meals? And
my wife's a really good cook, and I help prepare and clean. So,
you do?
Yeah, and eat. But I think, you know,
did you grow up in a household like
that?
My
mother could... Was a great
she was
cook.
A world-class cook.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, a lot of my friends would come over to my house to eat. So, you know, and they also liked to talk to my father, who was a very good storyteller. So, you know, my father was, like, very childlike in his, you know, like, if he'd watch movies with him, he was like, he was in the movie. You know, there's a movie that we used to watch together, Brute Force, that Burt Lancaster
was in.
Have you seen that? With Ewan Crone?
Yeah.
And my father was like, he was, like, in the movie, you know, with... So that's how it was at my house. Like you were in it.
My dad was the same way.
Yeah, you know.
My dad was my dad would come home from work and we'd lay there. And my mother was kind of with 6 children and no money to help her raise her children. My mother was completely, you know, blotto at the end of the night, asleep in her bed at like 10 o'clock. And I'd say, "Who's going to let Dad in the house?" I literally had a run of time, probably lasted about 2 or 3 years, where I got away with this. I'd say, "I'm going to stay up and make sure Dad's okay when he gets home." Mother would be like, and I go in the living room and wait for my father to come home. And I greet my father. Everybody else is asleep. And my father would be like, you know, very, you know, taciturn. "What are you doing up? It's 11:30. And I'd say, we'd sit down on the couch and he'd open up the New York Times. And they used to have those really pithy little capsule reviews in the Times of movies on The Late Show.
Right.
And he'd say, "Oh, that's a good one." I'd say, "What's that?" He'd say, "How Green Was My Valley." It's a great movie. Great movie. I go, "Well, maybe we could watch like 15 minutes of it." "All right, 15 minutes. We're going to watch 15 minutes of this movie. Then once you get upstairs, you get to bed. You got to go to school tomorrow." Yeah. And I sit there, and within 15 minutes, it worked like a charm. He'd pass out asleep.
Right.
And I'd watch all of How Green Was My Valley till 1 o'clock in the morning on the late show, you know. And at times that we would watch the movies together, he would like put his hand out during the moment, you know. He wishes to be accorded the same rights as a sponge. And my father would go, he wishes to think, you know, like Spencer Tracy and so forth. My father would quote all the lines.
Well,
you know, maybe it was the same for you, right?
Yeah, no, it was a real kind of sharing experience.
Now, your wife's a great cook. She comes from an Italian household, your wife.
No, wife's Russian Jewish.
I'm kidding, yeah.
No, I'm kidding. No. She learned to cook.
The Borowitz section of Bari, Italy.
She learned to cook.
Did she learn to cook from your family? How did she learn to cook? She's self-taught?
You know, has increased her repertoire over the years, yes. She's a very good cook.
And you made movies where this is the central...
Well, I've made movies. I made a documentary called Passione, which is all about Neapolitan music, because I was introduced to Neapolitan culture by Francesco Rosi. I've actually performed in the theater in Italy twice. That's an interesting experience, performing in the theater in Italy. It's very interesting.
How so?
Well, I did this one play. It's a play. It's like a neorealist play. It's a play about poor people. And the guy who's married to this woman, she has a lover, but he either imagines or he just makes him into a ghost because the guy leaves money, you know, for the whole thing. And at the end of the play, the guy goes away. He doesn't want to be the lover of his wife anymore. And the money dries up. And he sees the guy and he thinks he's a ghost, or maybe he's made himself think he's a ghost. And he explains to him, you know, it's hard to be in love when you don't have money. You know, if you can't buy someone a pair of earrings or a nice handkerchief, you know, the love can die. You know, if you're poor and you're starving. It's a beautiful speech. And it was written in 1946 by Eduardo Di Filippo. So I came out to do it in Naples, in English mostly. We did a little bit of Neapolitan. And when I came out to do the speech, I said the first line, and I saw rows of handkerchiefs come out of people's jackets, rows. And I was like, whoa, you know, because it distracts you, right? It's the white in the audience. And then I said a couple more lines, and then they were all, you know, working themselves up. They were doing this, basically the speech for me. You know, it was like I was surfing on their emotion. So I just had to say the line, and then you heard, oh! You know what I mean? And I was like, I can't believe this. I said, I haven't even done the speech. And there, so I was just kind of floating on this sea of white handkerchiefs. I never had experience like that ever in my life.
You know, I see people now in my own work, in my own life, where you are pitching and trying to make films and television shows and what have you. And it's so difficult to raise money now. It's this almost mind-bendingly difficult prospect. And this idea that the business was run years ago by people who were filmmakers. They had money. Studios were banks with billions of dollars and lines of credit up through the 80s. And then at some point, that changed. And now that people, that whole spiel about the corporatization of the media and so forth. How has it changed in your mind in the time you've been in the business?
It's much harder. I mean, the first movie I made was Columbia TriStar Home Video. It was Larry Estes, who gave money to a lot of small films, including Sex, Lies, and Videotape, One False Move. He must have done like 45 movies he financed. And I think we had a little over $2 million, but I had 43 days to shoot my first film. And my second film, I had 40 days. And you know, the film I did with, then I had like maybe 45 days. And then I had 30 days with the movie I made with Woody. And this last film, I had 28 days. And, you know, you're not 25. And, you know, it's hard to light someone, you know, beautifully in that amount of time. So you have to cobble it together if you're lucky enough. But I feel like people don't always bet on the person. And when I first started making movies, there were a few people I would talk to and they would bet on me. They would say, okay, I trust you. There was a man in Japan, gave me money for my second movie.
And how did that happen?
He was a distributor, and he would look at my presentation, saw all the pictures and the artwork, but he was also looking at me and trying to, you know, and judging me as a person. And he was, you know, he bet on me, not just all the people, all the names I have in it. So it's hard, you know, it's hard to make a movie because no one ever thinks about chemistry. You know, that's like the last thing people ever think about. And that it can be essential in a movie, whether you're playing your best friend or lovers or whatever. And, you know, almost everything is set up against you. So you have to be a little crazy and really love the material to say, well, I'm going to do something that's different. But of course, if you do that, then it's even harder, you know, because everybody's afraid. I mean, I made that movie with Woody, for example. I've always thought, well, maybe we would be interesting together. And the guy who cuts my hair cuts Woody's hair. And I happened to mention
it
to
him.
And he talks like this, you know. And he told Woody this idea that I had. And Woody was like, well, you know, have John call me. So, you know, I was like, what did you say to Woody? I told him this idea. So I went to Woody's office. I had no script, nothing. But I had directed some movies. And Woody, you know Woody well, because you work with him a lot. And I sat this close to him. And he said, so, you know, we share a barber, you know. I said, yeah. I said, yes. So I told him the story. I said, you know, you run a bookstore, you run out of money, and then, you know, you decide to pimp me out and blah, blah, blah. He goes, funny. You know, then I said something else. He goes, not funny. And then another something else could be funny, you know. So then he said, you write it, and then I'll give you my criticism, you know. Of course, I didn't know how merciless his criticism could be.
Was it?
Oh, my God. It was beyond merciless. And at the end of it, of course, he said, well, I could be wrong, you know. So anytime I would send him another draft, I would lay down and read his email. During the course of it, he asked me to direct these three one-acts, one of them that he had written, and I got to know him quite well.
Right.
And from that, I was able to rewrite it.
Who were the other two?
One by Elaine May. And Ethan Coen, and I survived. I did all these auditions with Woody, which was fascinating. You know, I mean, God, you know, he's a tough guy to audition for, you know. But I got to know him really well, and eventually, you know, he did sign off on the script, and he did a terrific job, and he was a wonderful actor to work with. He's such a good actor. And I was like, wow, this guy's good, you know. But it was a great experience. But I did 15 drafts. And he, you know.
Kicked your teeth out every
time. He was just
time.
Like, you know. And when I showed him the rough cut, he said, do you want my criticism? I was like, I said, well, I said, of course I do. And he goes, he said, you know, he was sitting in the chair. He goes, I'm going to be brutal, you know. And he really liked it. He was so surprised. And I was like, wow, you know, but it was a great, you know, experience. And I tailored it, obviously, to him. But my idea that we could be good together was true.
But the funny thing when I worked with him was the difference between that chasm between comedy and drama.
Oh, my God.
So we do Blue Jasmine, and Cate Blanchett is drinking Diet Cokes and chain smoking, and she's got to come in and do the scene where she comes apart, and we have this physical altercation in this house. Cate comes in and she does the scene, and Woody's like, you know, you're supposed to be at your wit's end here in this scene, and I'm just not buying it. I mean, you're supposed to be coming apart.
Yeah.
Completely coming apart.
Yeah,
and
sure.
We do another take, and she does the take, and she just wrings herself out. He's like, I'm just not buying it. I'm sorry.
You really
have to be just shattered, and you're broken into a mess. You're just a puddle of your own loss and everything. And smoking and drinking the coffee, and she comes in, she blows it. I hate to be the bearer of bad news all the time here.
Yeah, that's how
and
he is.
Just wrings her out, Then we turn around, we do a scene, and he goes, in this scene, say to her that she ought to go back to seeing that therapist of hers and just say some doctor's name. And I go, and he's looking down at the floor, and she's here, and you're me. And he goes, and just ad-lib some doctor's name. And I go, Dr. Fetterman. And he went, nothing funny.
Yeah.
Like, that's funny. No funny in this. There's not
a
funny
movie.
That's
a whole other thing. You know, he's tough, man. He's a tough dude.
Now, in the time we have left, because we are going to run out of time, unfortunately, so I want to talk to you about the HBO series. So this is a true story. I'll tell it quickly. I'm at Jimmy Gandolfini's memorial service. Jimmy passes away. I love Jimmy.
I was there too.
Jimmy was everybody who knew Jimmy loved Jimmy. He's a real great guy, a sweetheart, and so talented. And he passes away. They're going to shelve that project. And as I'm sitting there in the memorial service, Azalean is behind me. sitting behind me. They were waiting for everybody to file in. And I'm for about 15 seconds, I'm on the verge of pitching myself to Zalian for Jimmy's part at Jimmy's memorial service.
Actors.
Exactly. I'm going to turn to Zalian and go, you know. But anyway, no, I didn't do that. But so the whole thing goes away, and then it comes back, and you are the star of
show.
How did that happen?
Steve wanted me to be in his first movie, Searching for Bobby Fischer. So we've always, like, you know, I know he liked my work, and I liked him a lot. And I guess my name came up, and he really responded to it, and my agent talked to him. And then we met, and then he told me that it was James. And I didn't know it at that time, and James was the lead in my movie, Romance and Cigarettes. So I worked with James 2 years on it. I also know him from the time he did your play, because he's dear friends with my cousin Aida, and he's the one who helped cast her on The Sopranos. And I was very close to James, and I really had a lot of trepidation about it. And then I saw the pilot, which was much, much longer, and James was only in it for one little scene. Of course, he's still interesting with a big beard and everything, but he never talks to the guy. He just talks to the cop. And I said, okay, there's not that much of James that I have to kind of not think about. It was a really challenging experience. But I got to work with Bill Camp, he did his first job with me, Jeannie Berlin, and Riz Ahmed, who's wonderful in the show, is a wonderful guy. Mm. I just happened to really hit it off with him as like people. And I think it really helped us in the scenes. But it's, you know, it's about the system. It's about racism. It's about the city. It's about the criminal justice system. And when you read that article in the New Yorker about Khalif Bruder, the kid who was accused of stealing a backpack, you know, it's right on the money. And he was someone I actually wanted to meet, and then he took his own life. But I was really, you know, deeply interested and affected by doing something that I thought was a real fair representation. And Steve was indefatigable in his pursuit of truth and, you know, minutiae and detail. And it was a great, you know, you have to be given an opportunity to do something. So I knew, I said, well, this is a good opportunity. And I gave him my all.
Well, it's funny how that Jimmy, it's impossible to compare people. And it's a waste of time. But, you know, when he passed away, and Jimmy was somebody who he had his signature range and stamp and persona, and so much of it obviously dictated by one of the most successful TV shows ever.
I mean, you knew him right from the beginning, you know? I mean, you really
The show becomes a hit. Yeah. Greg Mosher calls me on the phone. I'm asleep. I flew in from L.A., and I'm sound asleep. And Mosher calls me, and I answer the phone. He literally goes, quick, who's the number one actor on TV? And I literally go, what? He goes, who's the number one actor on television? Who's the biggest star on television? I go, Michael J. Fox? And he goes, no, you idiot, it's Jimmy Gandolfini. Because he had just got nominated for an Emmy at that time, and the show was really taking off. And here was Jimmy, who had this small role in the play, and he went on to have this great, great career. However, and I'm going to almost wrap it up here with saying this, and that is, what I love about that show and what worked so great about that show is that no one can replace someone. It's not even about that. But when they looked for somebody who could create a character that could carry that show, you did such a fantastic job in that show. I loved watching you in that show. I'm so pissed off it ended. I can't wait. And so the question obviously is there a chance you might come back when you guys do another round, or you don't know?
Yeah, there's a chance.
There's a potential that you might do that.
There's a chance.
That's fantastic.
That's right.
So. Now, the last thing I want to ask you, you have such a deep, you're very soulful in the work you do. You're smart and you're aware. You're so many things inside of your acting that are so many good things for people to be. And I'm wondering, what do you attribute that to? If you can say, are you into meditation? How do you feed yourself?
I like other people. You know, I mean, like, it's funny, you know, when you asked me to do this, I was thinking, there's only a couple people who've ever written me a note as an actor, and you're one of them. You're like one of the three. Yeah, you wrote me like a note after I did Quiz Show. And, you know, I like other people, and I think that's a good thing. I think, and that keeps you fresh and alive, and if you're interested in other people and working with other people. And I think you're either, you know, curious about that or not, because you know, sometimes 1 + 1 can equal 5. You know, it can be a greater than the sum of its parts. And that's what, you know, interests me, is to have encounters with people. And so I don't know if I get that from my mom, you know, my dad, you know, but I don't take my opportunities lightly. I'm very thankful when I get a really good opportunity. And I still am. I mean, because I know how hard it is to, you know, there's a part of you, you feel like, yeah, I'm good, you know, when you're doing it. And then when it's over, you're like, well, did I really do that? You know, did I do okay? Or, you know, yeah, whatever, you know, it's like, and then it's kind of gone.
I feel like you're never done.
Yeah, you know, it's like you're still in the process of learning. And I think that's something that's good. You know, an actor, we can improve, actually. We, you know, we're not like done when we're 30.
When's your movie going to come out?
I don't know. I'm just beginning to edit
to it edit.
Right now. So,
and then what do you do? What do you do with the film? It's festivals, markets.
Well, you know, sometimes you can sell it in advance.
You can.
You know, there's people who want to see it, and we've shown a little teaser, and you know, you go.
You've been
there.
Down that road before, so you know what to do.
Believe me, I've been down that road. I have lugged.
You're cooking dinner for these people.
I've lugged film canisters around the country. You know what I mean? But that's okay. If there's something that you really love, that's all right. I've done it. So, but this case, I think we'll hopefully, you know, make a nice sale of the film.
Well, we're looking forward to see it. Thank you very much for
thank
doing
you
this
for
with
having
us.
Me. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Based on his previous work, it seems safe to say John Turturro is right. I'm Alec Baldwin. Here's the Thing comes from WNYC Studios.